Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan is making waves in the GOP with his roadmap for America's future. At 40, he's already six terms into Congress, one of three self-described Republican young guns in the House, a policy wonk and being hailed by those on the right as a visionary, even if his vision is a bit radical for many in the GOP. He'll lay that vision out for us this hour on Point Paul Ryan and American Enterprise Institute President Arthur Brooks on their prescription for America. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to bring down the axe all over on government spending? Are you ready to embrace this conservative vision for the country? Does it add up to a bright future? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from his home district in Janesville, southeast Wisconsin, is Paul Ryan, Republican representative for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District. He has outlined a plan to deeply reorder federal spending called a Roadmap for America's Future. He's co-author with Representatives Kevin McCarthy of California and Eric Cantor of Virginia of Young Guns, a new generation of conservative leaders. The Washington Post calls Ryan the GOP's leading intellectual in Congress. Representative Ryan, Paul Ryan, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thanks for having me today.
And from New York, we're joined by Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, a Washington think tank whose board includes former Vice President Dick Cheney. His new book is The Battle, How the Fight Between Free Enterprise and Big Government Will Shape America's Future. He wrote an op-ed last week in the Wall Street Journal with Ryan titled The Size of Government and the Choice This Fall. Arthur Brooks, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Paul.
Paul, first to you. Rising star is the word being put on you. What's the problem you're going at, and fundamentally, how are you going at it?
Well, the problem is the debt explosion that's coming in America. It's the fact that these very valuable social insurance strategies of the 20th century are going bankrupt in the 21st century. And what my proposition is let's get ahead of this debt crisis. Let's do it on our own terms so that we can preserve our social safety net and keep our economy growing and keep our liberty and freedom expanded. The fear I have is if we keep kicking the can down the road, if we don't face up to the explosion of entitlement spending, the debt that's coming, we're going to have bitter austerity plans like you're seeing in Europe and Greece, where you're cutting pensions to current seniors, raising taxes on the economy that slows down economic growth. What I'm basically trying to propose is a plan that I'm not saying that I have all the ideas. I'm putting a plan out there to try and get this debate going so that we can get ahead of this problem. My plan is to aim to do three things: pay off the debt, get the economy growing and make it very competitive in the 21st century global economy, and fulfill the mission of health and retirement security, which are ultimately the mission of these programs that are themselves going bankrupt.
You're looking to what? Eliminate the estate tax, capital gains tax, alternative minimum taxes, cut spending on the social safety net, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. Lots of very deep cuts in your plan.
Sure. So what I'm proposing is tax reform to make sure that we can get our companies, our employers, individuals in a position to thrive and grow and compete in the 21st century global economy. When you take a look at our tax code, it is one of the killers of competition. It is making it very difficult for Americans and American businesses to succeed and compete in this 21st century global economy. On the entitlement programs and the budget, my point is this. According to the General Accountability Office, we have a $76 trillion unfunded liability, meaning these programs themselves are growing themselves into extinction. And if you don't get ahead of the problem and make Social Security solvent, make Medicare and Medicaid solvent, then you're going to see these programs go away. These programs are unraveling themselves. So what I'm suggesting is if we act now, like I'm proposing, you can guarantee these programs are intact for people in and near retirement. Medicare and Social Security doesn't change at all, one iota, for anybody who's above 55, meaning if you're on these programs or within 10 years of retiring. And then what I propose to do is to reform them for future generations, which we, those of us who are younger than 54, know that they're not going to be there for us as they're currently constructed. I propose reforms that basically resemble the same kind of benefit structure I, as a congressman, have and all other federal employees have, the same kind of health care system, the same kind of retirement system. So I'd be glad to go through in specific what that means that I've proposed. But the point I'm trying to get to is this. We've got to get beyond considering these changes as third rails. We've got to have an adult conversation in America about how to get ahead of these fiscal challenges and the bankruptcy that's looming. The Congressional Budget Office just put out a harrowing report in July that says we're going to have our own debt crisis if we don't get ahead of things in America. And so what I'm trying to do is put a plan out there, not necessarily to say that I've got all the answers. Hmm. What I'm trying to do is get a plan out there to get this debate going. So while I enjoy the criticism because it at least gets some form of debate, it's not good enough. We need other people in Congress and around the country to come up with their plans to fix our fiscal problems so we can get on to a good high level of debate. And unfortunately, mine's the only plan out there. I'm hoping and waiting for others to put their ideas out there, other Republicans and other Democrats, so we can get on to actually solving this fiscal crisis in this country before it gets really ugly.
Paul Ryan, stand by. We'll look at that. Arthur Brooks, in New York, you like to frame this as a fundamental choice for the American electorate. How do you put that?
Well, you know, Paul has really elegantly laid out the accounting issues that we've got here. I mean, right now we're facing a crushing burden of debt, what most Americans think of as bad government stewardship and a lot of waste. And the trouble is that what this leads to is a much larger government necessarily in generations to come, less competition in the private economy, and a lot less opportunity for our kids and grandkids as entrepreneurs. I mean, these are just basic facts that come out of the accounting that Paul has talked about. What most Americans find really troubling about this, and I say this not just as a matter of my own philosophy, but looking at the public opinion polling on this issue, is that all of these things add up to a fundamentally different country than most of us have experienced when we were just coming out of college and starting our adult lives. And furthermore, a very different country than the one that we would like aspirationally to leave in our kids and grandkids. And what this adds up to is a bunch of economic problems that most Americans perceive, I believe correctly, as a cultural issue. We're changing our country to be much more one like the European social democracies. That's something that, according to all of the responsible data, that about 70% of Americans disagree with. And that's the reason there's so much energy, so much negative energy toward the current administration and Congress, and why there's so much energy to actually change things, and why we're looking so much for new solutions like we find from Paul.
Arthur Brooks, you know, Americans, if you say, do you want socialism? Well, many will say no. As you say, on the other hand, it's been often pointed out, Americans want a lot of what they have come to expect from government in the 20th century. Are you saying that has to go away to have a vibrant economy in the 21st century?
I think that we need a much, much tighter screen on what we do. I mean, the biggest problem that Paul and I in our work together have identified is that when you give people options for a growth of government piecemeal, one little tiny piece at a time, they'll usually accept. And the reason is because there's always a plausible and good reason, or a seemingly good reason, to expand the role of government without talking philosophically about what the government is supposed to do in its totality. But when you ask people aspirationally about the country that they want, they vigorously defend our culture of what they see as our culture of free enterprise. And what that really is a call is for leadership, for leaders who will stand up and say, let's think about what all of these little government programs, these entitlement expansions, these increases in discretionary spending, what they actually all add up to. They preclude our ability to do a lot of the things as private citizens that we would have wanted to in the past, and that's more than just money. That reflection of our character as an American people.
Paul Ryan, a lot of people look back at the decades, Ronald Reagan forward, and saying we had a big emphasis in this country on free enterprise, deregulation, and lots of leeway for corporations here. And yes, we had good years and bad years, but we ended up with a really bad situation here, and people saying they do not want to go back to that. There's an awful lot of pain that remains out there today. What do you say to that?
Well, I think we have to really respond to what is free enterprise. I think what has happened over the last number of years is really not a doctrine of free enterprise as much as a doctrine of what I would call crony capitalism, where you're seeing large established businesses come to Washington to engage in kind of a common cause to rig the rules in their favor. If you look at the Wall Street implosion, the credit bubble that burst, I would argue that government was in so many ways a creation of the problem. They started a lot of these issues, Fannie and Freddie, the kinds of rules that governed Wall Street that allowed people to sell these securities in a very non-transparent way. And so we have to get back to what is being free enterprise versus what is pro-business. Both Republicans and Democrats confused the notion of what it meant to be free enterprise with being pro-incumbent business. And so we got to get away from that. Transparent rules. We need, you know, real accountability. We need a system of free enterprise where large businesses can be displaced by small businesses, and we're not stacking rules in favor of these well-established large businesses that have leverage and access to politicians can come to Washington, and with the notion that if Washington's going to pick winners and losers, then they want to be winners. And that's my fear, is what both parties have strayed away toward. We've got to get back to what it truly means to have free enterprise policy, to have a one kind of common standard, so that businesses aren't coming to Washington for carve-outs or special exceptions. And that is the kind of mentality that led us to the kinds of problems that manifested with the crash we had in 2008 and beyond.
Congressman, the last I read, only 13 of your fellow Republicans in the House out of 178 have signed on to your roadmap for the American future. Does that mean that if the Republicans win, we will go right back to where we were before?
Well, not if I and others can help it. And so I wasn't putting this bill out there with the attempt to pass it. I knew that with a Pelosi Congress and a President Obama that I wasn't going to pass this legislation, so I wasn't shopping around for co-sponsors. What I was shopping around for was to elevate the level of debate, to actually put a plan out there to say, this, according to the Congressional Budget Office, actually solves our fiscal problems, pays off our debt, fulfills the mission of health and retirement security, gets our economy in an ultra-competitive mode for the 21st century. Let's get on with fixing these problems. And what I was trying to do, and still am, is encouraging other people to come up with their ideas if they don't like mine. Look, the Congressional Budget Office was very, very clear. We are, without a doubt, giving our kids and our grandkids a lower standard of living. We've never done that before. If we tackle this problem now, as the CBO certifies, my plan does, you can actually give the next generation a better standard of living, and that's what we ought to be doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about young guns, new and old ideas in the American conservative movement, with Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan, rising Republican star touted as the thinker of the party's hard right, Young Guns. He and Eric Cantor and Kevin McCarthy are out with their new book, Young Guns, A New Generation of Conservative Leaders. And he joins us from his district in Wisconsin, in Janesville there. From New York, we're joined by Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, who says it's time to go back to old, traditional American values. His new book is The Battle, How the Fight Between Free Enterprise and Big Government Will Shape America's Future. This is hot right now. This is very hot. Here's President Obama. This is, a couple of weeks ago in Parma, Ohio, talking about the philosophy he said reigned in Washington before he arrived. Then we'll hear from Michelle Bachmann just this weekend. First, President Obama.
Cut taxes, especially for millionaires and billionaires. Cut regulations for special interests. Cut trade deals, even if they didn't benefit our workers. Cut back on investments in our people and in our future, in education and clean energy and research and technology. The idea was that if we just had blind faith in the market, if we let corporations play by their own rules, if we left everyone else to fend for themselves, then America would grow and America would prosper.
There was an idea for a while, it did, then it didn't. Here, just this last weekend, Michelle Bachmann, Republican congresswoman from Minnesota, chair of the House Tea Party Caucus. This whole realm is very hot right now. She talked to voters at the Values Voter Summit in Washington, referred back to the Declaration of Independence. Here she is.
Would you like to alter your Congress? Would you like to alter the presidency? Supreme Court.
Change, change. But in what direction? Paul Ryan, give us a sense of what this country would look like if your full roadmap was laid out. What do we have now that we wouldn't have then, and what would we have that may be missing today?
What we wouldn't have is this crushing burden of debt that would be descending upon us. According to the Congressional Budget Office, my roadmap would put us on a path to actually paying off our debt. What we would have would be a safety net of income security. What I'm basically proposing is, rather than going down a debt crisis-driven, cradle-the-grave kind of welfare state, we would have a traditional opportunity society with a safety net underneath it. I think most Americans have come to the consensus that we ought to have a mission of our government as one that fulfills income security, health security, but does so in such a way that doesn't bankrupt our country and turn off our free enterprise system. I've heard these arguments from the president all along. He's putting up the proverbial straw man. He's done this quite a bit over and over. He's basically suggesting that what we're offering is either some sort of Hobbesian state of nature, a dog-eat-dog world where everybody's out to fend for themselves and the privileged take advantage and exploit everybody else. That's a straw man false argument. What we're talking about is having a level of security, fulfilling the mission of health and retirement security, but doing it in such a way that actually works so that we don't bankrupt our country. Get ahead of the debt crisis we have a tax system that is progressive but also is internationally competitive so Americans can compete. Have a health and retirement system that works for the 21st century kind of job market we have that doesn't bankrupt our country. And get the budget and the spending under control so we can pay off our debt. That is the question that is facing us right now. And what I would simply argue with the president, because he's already spoken through his own budget, he's doubling the debt in 5 years. He's tripling the debt in 10 years. He just created two new entitlements, which his own chief actuary is telling us are not paid for. They exacerbate our health care spending problems. They make the health care costs go up, not down. And so I would simply say that we are sort of at that choice of two futures. Which path do we want to go down? And what we're simply offering is an opportunity society with a safety net, the kind of traditional free enterprise system that we've known and enjoyed in America that's made us so exceptional, the American idea versus the trajectory we are on right now, which has recently been accelerated, which I would call, like what Arthur says, a social democracy, European-style, cradle of the grave welfare.
I want to look at that safety net, but let's look first at the budget itself and where we would end up fiscally here. You say we'd be in the clear with the roadmap for the American future. You've got big cuts in spending here, and everybody, you know, widely applauded for getting a conversation going. But the Tax Policy Center came in here and said that revenues would also fall under your plan by $4 trillion over the next decade. And if you added those revenue losses in, you get a much larger deficit in 2020 than we would otherwise, roughly $1.3 trillion that you're so focused on cutting spending,
right,
but not bringing in the revenues to really balance this thing. What do you say?
So obviously, I take issue with their numbers, but that's fine. I got Treasury Department to score my revenue side of the budget. They take issue with that. What I'm achieving here is to hit revenue targets. So if the Tax Policy Center is correct, when we actually are putting paper to pencil, or pencil to paper, excuse me, then we need to fix that so our revenue targets are established. What I'm trying to say is, if you try to tax your way out of this budget problem we have, you will crush the economy. I asked the Congressional Budget Office to actually run the numbers and tell me what our future income tax rates for my kids have to be if we try to tax our way out of this problem, because the spending gets out of control. The lowest tax bracket, the 10% bracket, goes to 25% according to CBO. Middle-income payers pay a 66% tax rate in the future. And the top tax rate, which is what the small businesses pay, the Subchapter S corporations, goes to 88%. So what I'm trying to say here is, you literally cannot tax your way out of this problem. Spending is the culprit. Just the interest on the debt under the president's budget itself goes from $200 billion this year to $1 trillion a year. It gets out of control. And my point is, we've got to get ahead of this debt crisis in this country if we want to maintain the American idea, our free enterprise system, and have a more prosperous future. You can have a system of health and retirement security without going down this bankrupt road we have, but you have to change these programs for the future so that they don't bankrupt us. And if you act now like I'm proposing, nobody who is in and near retirement, 55 and above, sees a change in their programs that they've already organized their retirement around. You kick the can down the road, the debt goes up $3 to $4 trillion every single year. That's what's irresponsible. Doing nothing to attack this debt crisis is to consign our next generation to a far inferior standard of living, to slow down the American economy, and give us not only a lost decade like Japan has, but a lost generation.
Arthur Brooks, you know, we went through a lot of years where, as I was saying, there's a lot of free market talk and a lot of tax cutting and a lot of deregulation, and we've got poverty now as high as it's been in a long, long time. And a lot of people, I mean, Paul says this is not a Hobbesian state of nature he's aiming for here, but a lot of people look out there and say, well, What's the guarantee of that? You know, why isn't this just a rich get richer and everybody else? You know what's happened to income distribution in this country over the last several decades.
Sure. And there has been, in fact, a lot of free market talk over the past decade. And as Paul indicated before, the problem is there hasn't been a whole lot of free market action. I mean, over the last administration, I mean, anybody who thinks that suddenly we've been, you know, abrogating free markets all over the place only since President Obama took over is simply not looking at the data. President Bush signed into law the largest single expansion of entitlement spending in America's history in Medicare Part D, and he signed legislation with 55,000 spending earmarks with no vetoes for abusive spending, and the list goes on and on. So there's nothing to say that this is a new problem. In fact, we've had free market rhetoric, but not very much free market action for a long time. The big question is, really, why do we care? I mean, we talk about, you know, moving away from our culture of free enterprise. Well, actually, there are a lot of people out there who say that would be great because they think that free enterprise is, in fact, the problem. But and this actually raises a question that I think that most Americans need to wrestle with. You know, why do we care about our traditional culture? And I think that we do have an answer to that. And the answer is that when you look at how most Americans see their lives, the optimism and the pathways they see to their own earned success, they believe that their greatest flourishing happens under a free enterprise system.
But when you say traditional culture, are you writing off everything since FDR? I mean, a lot of Americans look at the 20th century. Was a pretty good century, and it had, you know, also guarantees for Americans in there about retirement and about their health coverage when they were old, so that they didn't become impoverished and out on the street. Isn't that now traditional too?
Well, you know, once again, we have to stay away from the straw man argument of saying that the free enterprise system means zero government, which it does manifestly does not. I mean, even Friedrich Hayek, who was one of the greatest champions of free enterprise and free market economics in the 20th century, said that the government has a very legitimate role in looking at cases where markets fail and also establishing a basic standard of living for people so that we don't have the kind of abject poverty that we want to avoid as a civilized society. I mean, Paul and I agree on that, as do all responsible free marketeers and advocates of the free enterprise system. So the government has been able to achieve a lot of good things, and to deny that would be simply naive. The trouble is that we're moving right now into an environment, and we have been for at least the past 10 years and periodically over the past century as well, toward bailouts, social engineering, toward picking political winners with a whole lot of government money and frankly, good old-fashioned pork barrel spending. Those things don't fix market failures, and they don't establish a basic standard of living for poor people. And so those are the things that ultimately, which are incidentally driving up the crushing burden of debt. That's what really the stimulus is paying for. If you look at the programs that are listed in the what now $860 billion in last year's stimulus bill, and that's what most Americans so emotionally object to.
Paul Ryan, let's look at Social Security for a second. Under your plan, eventually what the Social Security age would go to 70. The government would guarantee performance of private accounts that people can set up. And people could then, you know, to take some of their savings and put it there instead of in regular Social Security.
Let me explain.
But I have a question for you.
Sure. I just want to make sure you're accurate about how you describe it, though.
Maybe you can explain the context of this question. I mean, a lot of people have money in private accounts already, 401ks, and in the 08 market crash, people lost an awful lot of money. I don't know if you'd spread it around, seniors lost something like $20,000 a head in that crash. Under your plan, if the market crashed again, and the markets crash, would the U.S. government really have the money necessary to make everybody whole? You're saying they'd be guaranteed. They wouldn't lose everything, but people lost a lot already this last time around. Can you really guarantee that without bankrupting the government?
Okay, so what I'm proposing is no change in Social Security for anybody 55 and above. For people who are 54 and below, we already know that Social Security is going bankrupt before we get there to retirement. So I'm saying you have a traditional system, the traditional program, which you slowly raise the retirement age beginning in the next decade, where it would not reach the age of 70 until the year 2103. I also am saying that if you're wealthy, you should not get as much of a benefit increase as everybody else. Doing those two changes puts Social Security on a path toward permanent solvency. If you're a younger person under 54 and you want to stay in the traditional Social Security program, you can do that. But if you want to have an additional option where you can have a personal retirement account that is not privatized, meaning run by some private broker, but managed by the federal government, exactly like the Federal Thrift Savings Plan that I, as a congressman, and all federal employees have, you can have that option as well. And what that option does is it has a life cycle account. so that it adjusts as you age, so that by the time you get near retirement, you're not even in the stock market. You're in safe bonds, so that those market crashes that might time right around the time you're retiring do not affect you. Yes, there's a minimum guarantee in the personal accounts that says you'll get everything that you put into it plus inflation. The trustees of Social Security who have scored this bill as achieving permanent solvency for Social Security say, yes, that is maintainable, because over anybody's 35-year working period, the stock market has always outperformed where we're going with Social Security. My three children, who are 5, 7, and 8, are scheduled to get a negative 1% rate of return on their Social Security taxes. That's if Social Security could pay them their benefit. Well, when 80% of Americans pay more in payroll taxes than they pay in income taxes, that's not a very good deal. And so what I simply want to do is just give younger people an extra choice, an option, just like I have as a congressman or a federal employee. If you want to have a 30-year payroll taxes go to this personal account managed by Social Security in the safe and secure way, you can have it. It's your property. That's your account. You can harness the power of compound interest so that at the end of the day, you get a better benefit. If you don't want it, then don't take it and stay in the traditional program. What I also do is I raise the minimum benefit for Social Security so no senior citizen in America falls beneath the poverty line, which is not what we have today. So what I'm trying to suggest here is there's a better way to make Social Security permanently solvent, keep the traditional system intact, and give younger people a voluntary option if they want to get a better return on their money and have an account that can't be taken away from them. That's part of their private property, right? That goes to their heirs when they pass on.
And they can't lose on. Sounds like it could be an expensive guarantee, but we hear what you're saying there. Stand by. Paul Ryan, Arthur Brooks. I want to bring our listeners in. Many banging at the door. David in Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, fellows. I'm 48 years old, and in some ways I'm as disillusioned as you folks have been about how government has played out here in the last 20 years. I consider myself a conservative, but for many years my father, who also considers himself a conservative, has said that small government can't really take hold until we get the campaign bribes, which are sometimes known as campaign donations, out of the way. And you almost have to have big government in the way as a speed bump of sorts so that, you know, the rest of us don't just get totally steamrolled. And I think we need, though, there's some great ideas that have been talked about here, but we have to assure that there's going to be some follow-through and accountability, and that we can also maybe get better representation from our elected officials. So I think we need to go to the American people, Paul, and talk also about the special position that you and others have. As congressmen, you often act like you're self-employed, independent businessmen, but you get the benefits of being an employee.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to have a job description for you guys. We need to have some sort of a clearinghouse or something that makes campaign donation anonymous, or makes them anonymous by the time they're received by you, so that we get some real follow-through that's in our best interest. These are great ideas that you're talking about, but we're ultimately going to have to get down to the rank-and-file congressmen and even in our state legislatures who are going to perform and not be on the phone making lots and lots of calls for donations and things.
Hey, David, our time is short before the break. Paul, you want to push government spending aside, but how do, especially since the Supreme Court is sort of let loose the flood with their Citizens United ruling. How do we make sure in this more free market environment you and Arthur push for that it's not just, you know, bought and paid for and owned by big money interests?
Number one, transparency is key. People ought to see where money goes in politics. Number two, we're living under the clean McCain-Feingold campaign system. This is campaign finance reform. I'm saying this with a tone of sarcasm in my voice, because ultimately you're not going to fix this problem until you decentralize power in Washington. Money will follow power, and if all the decisions and all the power is delegated to Washington, that's where it goes. I think the ultimate antidote to campaign finance reform is taking power and money out of Washington and sending it back to the states and the people in the first place. Otherwise, it will always find a way to trying to influence the system in Washington.
Arthur Brooks, whack down central government and the country as a whole emerges a winner. Does that really work in the 21st century? Look around the world at what's going on.
Well, a lot of it does work great. I mean, actually, if you look at countries around the world, what they're doing is decentralizing.
China?
You find that, some of our best competitors today, like Sweden, actually is moving in the direction exactly opposite from the United States, such that it can prosper even more. You see that this is the trend that's going on in democratic countries around the world, not
Germany.
Reverse. Germany, sure, actually. There's a lot of federalism in Germany today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about young guns, new and old ideas in the American conservative movement with Congressman from Wisconsin, Paul Ryan, rising Republican star touted as the thinker of the party's very conservative, fiscally conservative, so-called young guns. And with Arthur Brooks, president of the American Enterprise Institute, who says it's time to go back to old traditional American free enterprise values. Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska, and Craig. Craig, you're on with Paul Ryan and Arthur Brooks.
Thank you. I am 63. I have two graduate degrees from the UW system, and Paul Ryan is right only in the sense that we're near the abyss. He's wrong in the sense that everything he wants to do is going to push you closer to it. First of all, the new ideas we need are those from the progressive conservatism that we need to learn from Angela Merkel of the Christian Democrats in Germany, where it isn't the size of government, it's the efficiency and the effectiveness of Germany, of the government. Secondly, you have a situation in which the problem is a cultural one in the way a lot of our corporations think. Contrast BMW, most successful car company that I know, which feels that it has a social contrast with its workers.
Contract, yeah.
With General Motors, which has had a big plan in Paul Ryan's Janesville before it was completely reorganized and tried to inflict upon us such monstrosities as the Hummer Division and the Chevrolet SSR. Finally, the thing that they don't see, none of these conservatives, it isn't the Social Security problem, end quote. I know, I'm 63. Mm-hmm. The problem is that 40 years ago, we hit peak petroleum production in this country. We burned something like close to 400 million gallons of motor fuel a day. My brother, who's been in the petroleum geology exploration business for 35 years, can tell you, as can anyone else in that industry, that the world is at a plateau of peak energy. Demand is rising in overseas dramatically.
Craig, we've got it. You're thinking very fundamentally there, and I think we got the heart of your critique. Paul Ryan, Craig says, you know, you're right. We may be close to the abyss. He says you're wrong. You would push us over. And if I may, Paul, I mean, I'm looking here, David Brooks writing, I'm sure you saw this last week, saying
right.
His admiration for you personally and for Arthur Brooks personally and your thinking, he says, is unbounded. But then this is kind of in line with what Craig is saying, I think. He says, if the current Republican Party regards every new bit of government action as a step on the road to serfdom, then the party will be taking this long mainstream American tradition and exiling it from the GOP. So that would be a political tragedy. This is conservative columnist David Brooks. A political tragedy, a fiscal tragedy, a policy tragedy, and would leave us in big trouble. That's kind of Craig's complaint as well. What do you say, Paul?
Well, first of all, to the gentleman from Omaha, welcome to the Big Ten. We're excited about having Nebraska. Second, this is a very familiar debate I have in Madison all of the time between sort of a progressive vision for the country versus what we're proposing, the traditional American idea. We see things differently. And now, David Brooks and I and Arthur, we're all very good friends. It's sort of a Hamiltonian versus Jeffersonian version of the vision of the American idea, which is contrasting with the progressivist vision that you're getting out of Madison, Wisconsin, where it sort of came into America from Madison. The problem with that kind of an analysis or that pathway is it is unsustainable. You can't look at America today, look at social democracies overseas, and say that is something we can have and maintain because we are on such a dangerous trajectory of debt and deficits that these very progressivist notions of an ever-expanding state, an unlimiting principle, meaning no limiting principle to government, will surely bankrupt us. Our government for the last 40 years has been about 20% of our economy, meaning taking 20 cents out of every dollar made in America to pay for the federal government. Well, when my kids are my age, it goes to 40%, and then it goes up to 60% by the end of the century. The CBO runs numbers as to the future of the economy. A year ago, they said the economy collapsed in 2038 because of the unsustainable debt. This year, they're saying the economy will collapse in 2027 because of the path we are on. So if we accelerate this path towards sort of a cradle-to-grave progressivist welfare state, social democracy system, all we end up doing is accelerating this tipping point of a debt crisis.
But Arthur Brooks, I mean, David Brooks is very complimentary of both of you. But he then he goes on to say that what's being described here will be an intellectual tragedy as well. He says if all government action is automatically dismissed as quasi-socialist, then there's no need to think. A pall of dogmatism, quoting him, will settle over the right. Are you settling into a pall of dogmatism, Arthur?
Well, here I sit in my pall of dogmatism. What can I say? You know, I completely agree with David Brooks, and so does Paul, that if we were to say zeroing out government is the only path, we would be completely wrong. And that's, in fact, not what Paul and I have argued, and neither have either of us argued that individually. We want, and we're all for efficiency and effectiveness in government. But we also recognize that the size of government does matter. Most Americans don't want to go toward a social democratic system, no matter how efficient and effective the government is, because they understand, according to what most Americans believe, and every country has the right to its own self-determination, that when the government gets too large, that necessarily crowds out a whole lot of private sector activity. And according to most people's values, their vision of a better life, freedom matters a lot, and entrepreneurship matters a lot. Now, I'm not saying that that should matter as much to the Germans or as much to the French, but neither should we suppose that just because Germans and French like their social democratic system that would be better for Americans.
But what about the American system? No. What about the American system of the 20th century? I mean, David Brooks is saying, you know, no, you don't have to be François Mitterrand, but you don't have to be Barry Goldwater either, and that if you don't aim in between them rather than right of Barry Goldwater, the country's in trouble.
Well, that's in fact indeed the case. We actually need to find exactly what is the right balance. And the right balance necessarily means, number one, figuring out the aspiration. What is the system that we ultimately want that expresses our values, which Paul and I argue is more along the lines of a culture of free enterprise. And number two, figuring out exactly what efficient and effective government you want in what areas. That's the reason that we talk about figuring out where markets actually fail, as opposed to picking winners and losers and, you know, a lot of social engineering that other countries are a lot more comfortable with than we are.
Let's go to Beth in Salem, Massachusetts. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. This conversation is a lot about philosophy and political thought, and I'm an oncology social worker, and I'm concerned about how the rubber meets the road.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about Social Security recipients. Many of these people come to the system in a dependent state. Elderly in varying stages of dementia, the people that I work who are ill. Congressman Ryan is proposing that we give these people vouchers and tell them to go out into the marketplace and negotiate their own health care. This is ridiculous. He is presupposing capacity for ownership that just is not there in many cases.
That's a fact of life you see firsthand. Beth, thanks for your call. Paul, on the from Facebook comment, I've got one from Linda here, says, it seems to me the young guns are out to shoot the poor and elderly. But Beth works in it firsthand, and she knows individual responsibility can get tough. Let's look at Medicare and your plan. You would privatize a lot of it. Replacing Medicare with an $11,000 voucher. But what about the kind of people she works with? I don't know if you've got somebody in their 80s, she's in oncology, they got cancer and emphysema, glaucoma. You know, can they go out with your $11,000 and purchase a health insurance policy with that, or are they going to be on their own?
Under that definition, it's already privatized. The Medicare Advantage program, the fact that Medicare contracts with private vendors, under that definition of privatization, that it's already a privatized system. Here's the problem we have right now, and this is why I'm trying to get this to an adult level of conversation. Medicare right now is going bankrupt very quickly. It has a $38 trillion unfunded liability. And so what I'm suggesting is, unlike taking $522 billion out of the Medicare program, where the current actuary is telling us 15% of Medicare providers are going to go out of business or just stop taking Medicare patients, and spending that money on another program, which is what this Obamacare bill did, I'm saying keep Medicare as it's now structured for everybody 55 and above, the people she's consulting. And then for the future, because the program is going bankrupt, for 54 and below, switch Medicare to the same kind of system federal employees have. This was the result of the bipartisan commission that Bill Clinton set up in 1999, that Democrat Senator John Brough from Louisiana recommended, which is a premium support model. It's exactly like the federal employee health benefit plan. So the voucher, so to speak, is what we say it's means-tested and risk-adjusted. If you're poor, you get 100% out-of-pocket cost filled. If you're sick, you get more support, and if you're wealthy, you don't get as much. So if you do get cancer, if you do get these kinds of ailments, you get a much higher payment so that those out-of-pocket costs are covered. If you are in a dementia state, what Medicare will do is it will give you a list of pre-certified Medicare plans from which to choose from. If you need help choosing, then I'm sure a good social worker can help you choose the plan. The problem is Medicare, as it is currently designed, will not be there for the future because it is going broke. It is the largest fiscal problem we have in the federal government. The sooner we acknowledge that, the better off everybody's going to be. And if we don't start tackling this Medicare insolvency problem, then you're going to have very bitter and very tough across-the-board rationing. You're going to have the kinds of formulas that will dictate what kind of cancer treatments cancer patients can or cannot have, and that's not the path we want to go down in this country.
Arthur Brooks, I know I have to let you go. Let me just ask you this. Is the kind of roadmap that Paul Ryan's laying out here going to become the Republican policy? John Boehner's talked admiringly about it, but has been very explicit that it's not the ideas or the agenda for the GOP. Is this going to be picked up and run with or sit on the shelf?
Well, this Paul's plan is, as Paul indicates, the beginning of a very important conversation. Right now, the energy, political energy you see, is leading toward a very big political comeuppance, I believe, and that will be the beginning, that will be the impetus for a beginning of a conversation that will ultimately evolve into a set of workable policies. My belief is you have to start someplace, and Paul's plan does exactly that. Now, to react to this whole notion that it's all anti-poor and anti-old people, I mean, that's exactly what it's trying to the people we're trying to protect with a lot of the ideas with fiscal probity. I mean, the things that we're doing now that are racking up trillions of dollars in unfunded mandates and debt, this crushing burden of debt that we'll have to pay for, bailouts, you know, GM and Chrysler bailouts, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, this is all just welfare for middle-class people. And that's exactly what we need to be able to get away from such that the debt doesn't crush us so that we can't do the things that government should do, which is protect the vulnerable.
Arthur Brooks, author of The Battle, How the Fight Between Free and Enterprise and Big Government Will Shape America's Future, president of the American Enterprise Institute. Thank you for being with us today, Arthur Brooks.
Thank you for having me. Good to be with you too, Paul.
You too, Arthur.
Let's get another call from Omaha, Nebraska. William, you're on with Congressman Paul Ryan.
I'm one of the retired individuals here, and my wife is thinking about retiring, but because of what has happened, and I call a look at Jacob Hacker's book, The Great Risk Shift, mm-hmm. where the risk is being shifted to the middle class, where you're taking away the defined pensions. They're disappearing, and we're replacing them with a 401k, which is tied to the market. She's on a 401k. She's afraid to retire. So I don't know if she'll be able to retire by the time she's 67 or 70, depending on what the market is doing. And the view I have is your group is trying to push us to an oligarchy where you have the haves and the have-nots. And it's not a type of America that I think a lot of people would want to be part of.
William, our time is short, but I appreciate your call. Well, Paul Ryan?
I couldn't disagree with that more. Let me tell you what we're trying to do here. The social safety that we have in place today, it is going to be shredded if we don't fix these problems. Those who will get hurt the most are the least among us, the poor, the elderly, the sick. We've got to get ahead of that if we want to repair these tears in our social safety net.
But what about how we share the burden of that? I mean, I'm looking at some analysis of your tax plans that would mean, you know, a half million more in the pockets of Americans earning over a million and another $700, $800 a year for those making 40 to 50 sort of in the median.
What Arthur and I are saying and what is in the core of his book is our premise to treat poverty or is it our premise to try and eradicate poverty by promoting a prosperous free enterprise system? Do we want to put the entrepreneur and the individual as the nucleus of our economy and give them the kinds of tools they need to succeed and compete in this globalized economy? Or do we want to try and spread wealth around to manage decline? I mean, it is two different sort of approaches and doctrines that we're talking about.
Why? Why can't you have something in the middle, Paul?
That's what we're proposing.
David Brooks is saying something in the middle would work. He's saying this would be a political fiscal policy tragedy.
What Arthur and I are saying is we need to have a social safety net that works. We need to have a social safety net that's reliable. That's solvent, mm-hmm. that can continue. That is not what we have right now. The status quo itself is imploding. Social Security is scheduling a 22% across-the-board benefit cut under current law. So we've got to get ahead of these things. We should have a social safety net. That is a contract, a consensus values we've reached in the 20th century that ought to carry over to the 21st century, and we got to acknowledge that. But let's do so in a way that gives that individual the best chance at climbing up that rung of the economic ladder.
Can we really do this on spending cuts?
That allows people to make the most of their lives.
Yeah. Can we really do it on spending cuts with such a heavy emphasis there? I mean, you know, we've partied like it's 1999, and we've got a huge debt. I mean, don't we need, as distasteful as it may be, if we're serious, as you say, like adults here, maybe we need some more taxes too.
So the question that the reason why I don't go through all these tax increases is there's no end to it all. You would have to raise taxes so much to solve this problem. The other problem is we're in the 21st century now, not the 20th century, meaning we're no longer the undisputed economic superpower of the world. We have to be mindful of our tax rates so that we can make sure that our businesses can succeed in this global economy. When 97% of the world's consumers live outside of this country, we have to look toward exports. We have to look toward international economic competitiveness. And that is where tax policy can really hurt us if we do it wrong. Spending is the root cause of our problems. Spending is on a tear to explode, and that is the debt crisis. The kinds of spending cuts I'm talking about are really, in aggregate, slowing the growth of spending. And where do I propose to spend less money? On the wealthy. I think that means testing these programs is the smartest way to go, because wealthy people have more money, therefore they can afford these kinds of subsidies on their own than the poor.
Congressman, we've just got 20 seconds. Do you think the GOP is going to come around to making your roadmap its agenda, or are you?
I really don't know the answer. I wrote this as a consensus of one person myself. If we're actually in the majority, then I have to get a consensus of at least 218 people, so I have no idea what it's going to look like at the end of the day.
Is this a Tea Party vision or something else?
It's a vision to reclaim the American idea and restore those founding principles that made us so exceptional in the first place.
Paul Ryan, congressman in his sixth term, elected when he was 28, going for a seventh now, from Wisconsin's first congressional district, joining us today from Janesville, Wisconsin. He is co-author, along with Republican Representatives Kevin McCarthy and Eric Cantor, of Young Guns, a new generation of conservative leaders. His plan is called A Roadmap for America's Future. Congressman Ryan, thank you very much for being
thank
with
you,
us
Tom.
Today. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.